I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. The Republican National Convention gets off to a soggy start this week in Tampa. I'll talk with WUSF reporter John O'Connor from the RNC about excitement in GOP ranks at the start of the election season. Plus, Graham Parsons was a pioneer of country rock in the 1960s and 70s. His musical roots traced to Central Florida, and local writer and journalist Bob Keeling joins me for a discussion about his new book, Calling Me Home, Graham Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock. That's ahead on Intersection. Tropical weather delayed and shortened the Republican National Convention. WUSF reporter John O'Connor joins me for a discussion about what's happening at the Tampa Bay Times Forum, where the RNC is being hosted. John, it's good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So, John O'Connor, what is the mood as the Republican National Convention is getting ready to get underway, and the outlook then for the rest of the week?
Sure. Coming into the convention, there were two big concerns, and that was the weather and the protesters. And the weather seems to be, you know, not as much of a story as was feared, at least for Tampa. And the protesters have also been kind of less of a disturbance as first predicted as well. They had a few hundred protesters come through. The rally was not, again, didn't shut down downtown streets. Folks could get to work on time. Did not seem to be a major disturbance. Going forward here, we've got the actual nuts and bolts work for the convention, including the actual nomination of Governor Romney as the Republican nominee for president. That's expected to happen later this week. We've also got a lineup of Florida speakers coming through and national speakers coming through. Governor Bush is going to speak. We're going to have U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, who is expected to introduce Governor Romney on Thursday. And so it's going to have a real Florida flavor here for the rest of the week.
So at this point, how much of an adjustment has the RNC had to make? What's being left out?
Well, some folks are going to have to shorten their speeches. They're not going to have as much time on center stage to build their national reputations. Some folks are being left out entirely, including Governor Scott, who's withdrawn his RNC activities so that he can focus on Tropical Storm Isaac and whether it hits in the panhandle and anything else that needs to be done along Florida's coast. So they're compressing the schedule, but they've got a template for this because this happened in 2008 as well. They got rid of the Monday session because of Hurricane Gustav. And so, again, they compressed everything down into 3 days. And for the most part, it really didn't make much of a difference. Monday is kind of a party night or at least an entertainment night for most folks. There's not a whole lot of work that gets done. So it's easier for them to cancel Monday and squeeze everything into the other days.
John O'Connor, what is the mood going forward? The RNC convention is supposed to be a big kickoff, kind of a party atmosphere, and certainly having a major storm pass through and shifting the schedule, it changes the mood. Do you think, are Republicans still excited about this? Do you think there's still going to be a boost of enthusiasm for the party faithful?
Yes and no. There is concern, of course, if a major storm hits New Orleans area, about, you know, the concern for the folks there, that there's also the political fallout of what happened after Katrina hit in New Orleans. So there is some concern there. But I've spoken with folks at events all week, including the Ron Paul rally, folks milling about downtown, and they're excited to be here. They're excited to make their voices heard, to be able to get out there and try and support their candidate and build some enthusiasm for the party platform, the party's positions, and then the party's political prospects this fall.
Well, give us a sense. You mentioned that there's going to be a host of Florida speakers, including former Governor Jeb Bush, Florida Senator Marco Rubio. How much of a rally cry is this for Florida in terms of being represented at this national stage event?
Well, we have a number of Florida folks who are going to get prime time, you know, some of the most choice speaking roles at this convention. Jeb Bush is going to be featured Wednesday night. Senator Rubio is going to be featured Thursday night, introducing Governor Romney. Attorney General Pam Bondi is going to speak. I've also heard complaints that there weren't enough Florida representation here at the convention. Obviously, this event is a way to showcase Florida, to showcase Tampa, to, you know, the Tampa Bay Times had a story this week about how Florida is essentially the most important political state in the country, made some really strong cases about, you know, Florida is more diverse than other states. It's got a diversity of ethnicities, of wealth and income, of kind of philosophical beliefs within the Republican Party. And so, you know, this is a chance to show off Tampa, to show off Florida, and to really put the emphasis on this state, this state's political climate.
That's John O'Connor, journalist with WUSF in Tampa, speaking to us from the Republican National Convention at the Tampa Bay Times Forum. Good to speak to you, John.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, musical pioneer Graham Parsons and his Central Florida roots. Hickory Wind off the Byrds album Sweetheart of the Rodeo. Singer-songwriter Graham Parsons played with the Byrds. He was a pioneer of country rock, a musician of the 1970s, known for his work with the International Submarine Band, the Byrds, the Flying Burrito Brothers, and today artists as diverse as Elvis Costello, Dwight Yoakam, Ryan Adams all pay tribute to Parsons, whose musical roots were in Central Florida. Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones called Parsons one of the two most pure musicians he knew, the only other in that category, John Lennon. But Graham Parsons, not very well known. His death at the age of 26 from a drug overdose cut his career short, and Bob Keeling, reporter with WESH TV in Orlando, is writing a new book called Calling Me Home, Graham Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock. He's here to talk about it. Bob Keeling, great to have you with us.
Mark, thanks for having me back.
So talk to us about Graham Parsons. His career was so short, but so many people cite him as a major influence. What was it about him and his music that made him influential and revolutionary?
I think Graham was a pioneer in bringing very disparate genres of music together. You have to remember now, when we're talking about the time period involved here, 1968, on one side, you had the rock and roll crowd, which represented the far more liberal, some might even say pot-smoking young generation. And then you had the country crowd, which was associated with the crew cuts. And remember, we're talking about the time of Vietnam, so you're talking about the America Love It or Leave It crowd. So you had essentially a cultural chasm between these two types of music. And one of the many things Graham did was bridge that gap, bridge that generational cultural gap, and in a sense desegregated those two idioms. So it was far more than just saying, oh, he's the father of country rock.
So where do we see his influence today?
In people like, for instance, the woman he mentored and basically plucked out of Georgetown as a nobody, a woman named Emmylou Harris, who, of course, we all know now, and she was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2008. She's one of many who claim Graham Parsons as an influence. Many of the names you talked about, even Central and North Central Floridian Tom Petty, said that Graham Parsons and his group, the Flying Burrito Brothers, were a big influence on him as well. So many of the contemporary artists in this sort of alt-country genre that they call it today see Graham Parsons as a founding father.
Now, let's talk a little bit about cosmic American music, which is how Graham Parsons described his work, a blending of styles in the same way Ray Charles, Elvis Presley all brought spirituals and hymns into popular music. Why did Graham Parsons use this term, cosmic American music?
Well, it's kind of a catch-all to talk about what you were just mentioning. It's the kind of music that spans, it defies pigeonholing, let's put it that way. And he always enjoyed the fact that you could bring the long hairs together, you could bring the country crowd together. That I remember a quote for him saying that type of thing where he goes, it just turns me on to be able to bring these disparate groups of folks together. And that was sort of his umbrella phrase, cosmic American music. But I think what he really meant was it was the kind of music that defied pigeonholing, that it was taking music in a different direction. And certainly playing with the most important American band of the 1960s, the Byrds, on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry and taking them country at a time when country was not seen as cool at all was way ahead of its time.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Gram Parsons. Here's a song called I Can't Dance off his self-titled solo album. You can really hear in that country and rock coming together, but what do you hear in that song?
You know what I hear? I think back to when Graham was 9 years old, and he went to a concert in his hometown of Waycross, Georgia, to see a young musician that they called Kid Dynamite by the name of Elvis Presley. And that changed his life. So much so that when Graham finally became the musician he wanted to be, and he got a chance to make that record you just played, he actually hired Elvis's backup band, including the great guitarist James Burton, because he wanted to emulate Elvis. And what a great backup band he had for that record.
So when Gram Parsons is coming into this, you mentioned in this cosmic American music that he was also trying to cross racial barriers and really pull together the essence of American music together. Was that hard, given his background coming up right here in Central Florida?
Well, that's such an interesting point you bring up, because back in the early 60s, some of the people that Graham was closest to were, quote-unquote, the help. They had his family had the family maid and the person who would take care of the yard, and they happened to be African-American, and they had a young son who Graham counted on as a friend. And remember, we're talking about the segregated South of the 1960s, and Graham always had a very progressive attitude towards that. And one of Graham's friends told me this story about when they were in junior high school, and an African-American man coming to pick them up in a station wagon, and it was like, whoa, what is going on here? And Graham's like, no, he's a friend, come on, it's okay. And later on, Graham became a big fan of folk music with this group, The Journeymen, that included John Phillips and Scott McKenzie and Dick Wiseman. And The Journeymen were touring with African-American acts in the South in the early 60s. And they took a lot of criticism and threats, because that just wasn't the thing to do back then.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that early part of Gram Parsons' life. He grew up in Waycross, Georgia, but was born in Winter Haven and came from a family that were citrus magnates around the area.
Yeah, Gram's grandfather, John Snively, was one of the richest citrus barons in all of Central Florida. His family mansion to this day is in the middle of what is now Legoland in Winter Haven. But early on, Graham's parents moved to Waycross, and Graham grew up there and came from an upper-middle-class family. He lived an upper-middle-class lifestyle. I wouldn't say he was rich by any measure, but certainly they weren't worried about where their next meal was going to come from. And as a result, Graham is sort of part Old South aristocracy, also part sort of freewheeling young musician from an upper-middle-class suburban home, like so many kids were in the 60s.
But he kind of did get branded a little bit as a trust fund rocker or something.
Yeah, he did, and rightfully so in some ways, that Graham didn't have to struggle and monetarily, and he didn't have to work hard on the road like so many country musicians do. But on the other hand, Graham had his own share of struggles within his family because both of his parents were alcoholics. His adoptive father was an alcoholic. And Graham saw his share of the blues. Money certainly did not buy happiness in his family. So he had his share of difficulty. It just wasn't the normal country way that you hear with so many country songs and that type of thing. But it was an interesting duality in his life.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Bob Keeling. He's author of the new book called Calling Me Home, Graham Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock. I'm Mark Simpson. What's your favorite Graham Parsons tune? Tell us about it on Facebook or Twitter. You can send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. Now, even though, Bob, we associate Graham Parsons with country rock and he was from the South, he wasn't seriously interested in country music until he heard Merle Haggard for the first time, and that was when Graham was studying at Harvard University in Cambridge.
Well, that's part of it, but actually what really got him started was coming back from Greenwich Village in 1965, right before he went to Harvard. And he could see that the folk thing just wasn't going to happen. He was part of this folk group called the Shilohs, and they had broken up in 1965, and he'd gone to Greenwich Village for the summer. So he comes back to Winter Haven, and he's seeing his good friend, who's like an older brother, Jim Stafford. And they're sitting in his living room, and Jim actually took me back to this very living room. And Graham's just telling him, you know, this folk thing just isn't going to happen. And Stafford just sort of says extemporaneously, well, why don't you be a country Beatle? Maybe you could be the first long hair to play country music. And that's exactly what happened. But instead of becoming a country Beatle, Graham actually became a country bird with the group The Birds. But that's really where it started, was with Jim Stafford giving him that advice in his living room here in Central Florida.
So take us from Harvard to The Birds. How does that connection happen?
Well, Graham gets to Harvard and he meets up with a group of like-minded musicians and they start tooling around for a sound. And for a while, it was kind of contemporary music. And then you're right. He listens to George Jones and Merle Haggard and really is transformed. So they're playing some gigs up there, 65, 66, throughout New England. They do some touring back here in Central Florida as well. But Graham goes out west to hang out there. He falls in love with the woman who later became the mother of his only child, moved out that way, hooked up with some musicians who became this loose confederacy of musicians called the International Submarine Band. And with them in 1967, Graham cuts what many believe is the archetypical country rock record called Safe at Home with this group, the International Submarine Band.
And so then how does Graham Parsons then get connected with the Birds?
Well, as Graham is doing those sessions, the Birds are kind of falling apart. Their great songwriter Gene Clark has left the band. David Crosby is having difficulty, and he ends up getting fired. And so Graham starts working as a side man with them. Just before that happens, he meets up with Chris Hillman, the group's bassist, in a bank line in Beverly Hills. And they start talking, and Chris is like, yeah, I've heard of you. So Graham comes over for an audition, and Roger McGuinn went through that with me and told me about, yeah, this guy played me some piano, and I thought, okay, he'd be a pretty good sideman. Little did I know that I had hired George Jones in a rhinestone suit in Graham Parsons.
Now, what was that relationship like with the Birds? Because in your book, you talk about there's some controversy about whether or not Graham was a full-fledged member of the group, and this was maybe the second evolution of the Birds as they kind of shifted into country music. What was that relationship like?
Well, Graham was definitely just a sideman. He was a salaried sideman in the Birds. We're talking early 1968. So he makes Sweetheart of the Rodeo with them, their landmark record. They go over to England to do a couple of gigs over there. And at that time, Graham and the Birds meet Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and the Rolling Stones. They hang out together. They go out to Stonehenge. They're partying. And the Birds are supposed to fly to South Africa to play a tour, and Graham's supposed to go with them. And Keith Richards says, now famously, oh, they have segregated audiences down there in South Africa. You shouldn't be going there. And Graham says, okay, well, I won't. And essentially quits the Byrds, the people who gave him this great opportunity and bought into his risky vision. He just quits the band. And there's one school of thought that says Graham stood on his principles and that's why he quit. But there's a more cynical side of people who say, no, he just wanted to hang out with Keith Richards and suck up to the Stones.
Well, certainly in Keith Richards' own biography, he really does speak quite affectionately about the time spent with Graham Parsons. And I wonder if this is a moment to segue into some other parts of Parsons' life. It's almost overshadowed the music, the drug and alcohol use, especially legendary when he was hanging out partying with the Rolling Stones. What do you think was your read on the impact of hanging out with the Stones, because this was a legendary part of their career as well when they ended up going down to southern France and recording Exile on Main Street. Graham Parsons was there.
Yes, he was. And I think they benefited a lot more from his influence than vice versa. I think the Stones were a distracting factor in Graham's own career pursuits because he was just so enamored with them and saw the possibility of Keith Richards maybe producing Graham's solo record down the road. So as the Stones are trying to make this great record in the south of France, they have all of these hangers on, and there's all of this drug activity going on, and Mick Jagger is getting pretty fed up, and Graham is seen as one of the hangers on, basically, and they finally tell him, you got to go.
What happens when Graham Parsons departs France and the Rolling Stones? Where does his career take him then?
Well, Graham, at that point, was really at a low point. After the Stones basically kick him out of the south of France, he goes back to England, and he's doing such heavy drugs. There was a kind of a hippie doctor who talked about having to save Graham from overdosing two or three times, and he really could have died even before he made his legendary solo records, but he decides, you know what, I got to get my life together. So he marries his teenage girlfriend, Gretchen, and he gets the opportunity, the historic opportunity, to make a solo record. And at about the same time, his old bandmates say, hey, we're up here in Georgetown, and we're hearing this woman, this folky, her name is Emmy Lou, and you got to come up and hear her. So he catches a train up. She's playing at a place called Clyde's in Georgetown. She's a nobody. But Graham hears her voice, and they sing a song together called That's All It Took. And literally, that's all it took. And the rest is history in terms of those two making his landmark solo records.
Well, we've got a clip from a rare interview, 1973, of Graham and Emmy Lou Harris during their only tour together. And this interview, they start to sing the song, the Everly Brothers song, Love Hurts.
What, do you want to play a cut now?
Nope, I want you to play a cut. live and original.
Okay.
Right here, huh?
Yep.
You asked for it. Well, let's do something that might be on a future album.
And really work together as a duo there.
You do. And for Graham, I wrote that Love Hurts wasn't just a song, it was also a statement of fact. Growing up as the child of alcoholics, he even talked about seeing the people around him that he loved die way too early. And I think in hearing that song, what makes his fans so especially devoted is you just had this sense that had he not died within 6 or 7 months of that song, it was all waiting for him. The whole wave of country rock, the validation he was looking for, that was all just around the corner. But it was his, it was his mentor there, Emmy Lou, that you heard in that song. She took the torch and ran with it, and saw all of the success that was waiting just down the road for Gram Parsons had he not died.
And that death has gotten so much attention. Maybe you could describe the scene for us. Age 26, strange circumstances around Gram Parsons' death and what eventually happened to his remains.
Yeah, and that's how a lot of people know about Gram Parsons. They're like, oh, he's the guy whose body got stolen. Well, what happened was, in July of that year, a great guitarist by the name of Clarence White was killed by a drunk driver. And they were all at his funeral. It was a regular mass, and it was just such a somber affair, and there was no music, and Gram was intoxicated, and he happened to mention to a number of friends, Roger McGuinn included, who said, yeah, I heard him say, if this ever happens to me, don't let it happen to me. Take me out to Joshua Tree and burn my body. And so, as fate would have it, he dies not 2 months later, and his road manager decides he's going to fulfill Graham's wishes and takes an old hearse to LAX Airport and convinces the people there that, oh, I'm here to take his body to wherever, and they release Graham's body to the road manager, Phil Kaufman, who takes it out to Joshua Tree, California, at a place called Cap Rock, and sets it afire in the coffin. But the part of the story you don't hear is that the fire went out and the coffin was abandoned to be discovered by park rangers. And I think that part of this story has become such a giant distraction that it's taken away from Graham's true legacy, which is the music we've been talking about in most of this show.
So what is your hope in terms of, now that the book is out, the impact it'll have on reigniting interest in Gram Parsons and the musical legacy that he has?
Well, one of the things that's going on right now is a fella from New York by the name of Will James has had a petition going on online for years now, and he's gathered 7,500 signatures to see Gram be inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. And I wholeheartedly support that effort because it's high time someone as influential and pioneering as Gram Parsons be inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. And you can actually find that petition online and sign it yourself if you feel strongly about it. And I'm going to be in Nashville for a show on November 3rd, which is called Gram International. It's the fifth version up in Nashville, where it's all about support of that record and like-minded musicians play. And there's going to be the guy who co-wrote Hickory Wind, Bob Buchanan, is going to be up there, and Graham's niece, who I interviewed for the book. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great time.
I've been speaking with Bob Keeling, author of the new book, Calling Me Home, Gram Parsons and the Roots of Country Rock. Bob Keeling, great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks, Mark. It went quickly.
We'll go out listening to Gram Parsons perform the Rolling Stones song Wild Horses. The Stones allowed Parsons to record the song before they released it in 1971. You can hear author Bob Keeling read a passage from his book online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.
Childhood living. It's easy.